It's Sunday and I decided to pay a visit to the Malibu Hindu Temple, located in the city of Calabasas in the Santa Monica Mountains. This temple was built in 1981 and dedicated to the Hindu god Venkateswara, also known by various other names, which is a form of the god Vishnu. Venkateswara literally means Lord of Venkata, and according to Hindu Puranas or ancient texts, the word Venkata means destroyer of sins. There are numerous acts that are regarded as sinful in Hindu philosophy, such as stealing, indulging in violence, rape, and lying. That said, another transgression that must be avoided at all costs is a frivolous waste of one's life force energy. In Hindu mythology and Vedic culture, there's a vivid description about Brahmacharya, which means strictly following or adopting the path to reach Brahma, or God. In this path, the individual needs to conserve his semen, which adds to his spiritual vitality, taking him closer to the Supreme Soul. Loss of semen is considered as the biggest obstacle in the path of Brahmacharya. In the ancient Indian epic Ramayana, Lord Rama's younger brother, Laxmana, had maintained Brahmacharya for 14 years, allegedly growing very powerful through inner alchemy and sacred tantric practices thought to fortify the soul and nourish one's bioelectromagnetic energy. Ancient Indian teaching concerning sexuality, such as in the Vedas, Puranas, and other religious literatures, emphasize the importance of harnessing and transmuting one's life force energy, which in India is called prana, and it's called chi in other parts of Asia that practice Buddhism or follow Taoist philosophy. Islamic texts frown upon masturbation until one achieves a mission, and Orthodox Christianity also considers such behavior as sinful. The Gnostics considered the most essential part of the process of salvation to be personal inner knowledge, and the biblical serpent in the Garden of Eden was praised and thanked for bringing this esoteric knowledge, or gnosis, to Adam and Eve. In the Gnostic interpretation of the Garden of Eden story, as mirrored in the Zohar, the serpent tells Eve that eating the forbidden fruit, which represents the orgasm, will bring about spiritual slumber or death, as warned by God. But touching the fruit and not eating it will bring about enlightenment. In other words, partaking in the fruit or engaging in sacred tantric union without passing the point of climax can potentially lead to a kundalini awakening, an energetic merging with divinity, and heightened spiritual awareness, vitality, and fortitude. The snake tempted her to touch but not eat. This vital detail is not present in modern edited revisions of the ancient story, but is common knowledge in occult and mystery school versions passed down orally to initiates. The official religion in Thailand is Theravada Buddhism, practiced by more than 95% of the population. Buddhism originated in India in the 6th century BC, founded by Prince Siddhartha Gautama, then later arrived in Thailand from Sri Lanka, becoming the dominant religion in the 12th century. The King of Thailand is not only the head of state and the armed forces, he's also the upholder of the Buddhist religion. the current Thai king, Vajira Longkorn, who has four wives and dozens of mistresses in his royal harem, is also an adherent to an esoteric early form of Buddhism that incorporates sacred techniques, which makes use of tantric union with a consort in order to cultivate an inner heat, known as tummo in Tibetan Buddhism, to achieve a heightened state of bliss and altered states of consciousness. In Tibetan Buddhism, tummo is the fierce goddess of heat and passion. Tummo is also a tantric practice for inner heat developed around the concept of a female deity. It is found in the six dharmas of Naropa, a set of advanced Tibetan Buddhist tantric practices, also known as, quote, the oral instruction transmission for achieving liberation. They traditionally require a tantric initiation and personal instruction through working with a tantric guru, as well as working with the subtle body, particularly through the generation of inner or mystic heat energy. Initiation was passed on through secret oral instruction, with the most revered written fundamental tantric texts accepted by the Tibetans since the 8th century having been written by women. It is said that Prince Siddhartha became a Buddha, or awakened one, after 49 days of meditating under a Bodhi tree. Of course, a Bodhi tree is actually a fig tree, and in an esoteric symbolic context, the fig represents fertility and sex, also attributed to Aphrodite, the goddess of love, as well as Bacchus, or Dionysus. And a tree is a universal symbol for the awakened Kundalini. According to mystery school initiate Samuel Anwayor in his book Ignatius Rose, quote, the rooster and the fig tree represent the sexual forces. It is impossible to reach deep realization without the alchemy of the feminine solar forces. The fig tree symbolizes the feminine energetic forces that we must learn how to control. This esoteric aspect of Buddhism is more overtly displayed in Tibetan Buddhist art, which depicts a male and female deity in union in a tantric pose with the female seated on the male's lap. Before the advent of the Catholic Church, stemming from the remnants of the Roman Empire, the serpent was seen as a trickster character, similar to the mythical role of Prometheus, who stole the fire from the gods to give it to mankind. In folklore and religion, the trickster in the story disobeys the rules, defying conventional behavior in order to convey or impart secret or esoteric knowledge, sometimes referred to as light. While Luciferianism is often associated with a devil figure or Satan, Lucifer, which literally means light bearer in Latin, is part of a philosophy representing various interpretations of the morning star as understood by ancient cultures, such as the Greeks and Egyptians. In this context, Lucifer is a symbol of enlightenment, which did not require external middlemen, such as priests or a pope. In Thailand, the Naga is the name given to semi-divine serpent beings, originally derived from Sanskrit and prominent in Buddhism, Hinduism, and Jainism. While the dragon is a symbol of evil in Christian traditions, in the East, it symbolizes supernatural power, esoteric wisdom, spiritual strength, and hidden knowledge. In pagan Europe, for example, serpents were revered in ancient Ireland, where a serpent tribe once existed, which the church remembers in the story of St. Patrick driving out the snakes, even though snakes never existed in Ireland for the entire duration of the Holocene. The snake was the Celtic symbol of rebirth, healing, and wisdom. There are also serpent-shaped swastikas buried in 3,000-year-old pre-Christian Nordic graves. Serpents, dragons, and worms at one time were seen as the holders of esoteric knowledge. in the formation of Christianity, various Gnostic sects were labeled as heretical, as they emphasized spiritual knowledge, or gnosis, of what they interpreted as the divine light within, over blind faith in hierarchical traditions of the authoritarian church. Dragons could also symbolically embody the defeated menace to organized religion known as paganism, as was the case with Saint George, a 3rd century military saint from the eastern Mediterranean. George supposedly slew his dragon in the Roman province of Libya in North Africa. For later Christians, this monster represented the pagans of the era, threatening the virtue of Christian maidens, only to be defeated by the knight. By the time dragon slaying became the most commonly portrayed element of his story, during the High Middle Ages, George's battle was also used to talk about contemporary Western knighthood and conflicts between Christians and Eurasian invaders, such as the Huns and later Muslims. Thus, the monsters of the medieval era are simultaneously natural and supernatural, both metaphors and more than that. One of the most important works of Old English literature, Beowulf is an epic poem consisting of over 3,000 lines, beautifully written in alliterative verse, which means the words have a sort of rhythm, where they repeat the same sound in a sentence in a poetic manner. The repetition of sounds not only creates an effect that is pleasing to the ear, but it also serves a key function when relating long, important stories orally, in that hearing the similar sounds in succession helps listeners better remember the information they hear. Set in Scandinavia, Beowulf was a hero of a northern Germanic tribe in what is now southern Sweden, who comes to the aid of a Danish king who came under attack by Grendel, a descendant of the biblical Cain, described as, quote, a creature of darkness, exiled from happiness and accursed of God, the destroyer and devourer of our humankind. While he is usually depicted as a giant monster in art and movies, this supernatural appearance is not clearly described in the poem, and is often added as embellishment from a later time, the subject of numerous reinterpretations. That said, it does say he consumes his victims and therefore seems to have been a cannibal. After Beowulf slays him with his bare hands, Grendel's mother also launches an attack, but is also defeated with a giant sword that he found in her lair. Victorious, Beowulf goes home to Sweden and becomes king of a sect of seafaring Goths called the Geats. Before the consolidation of Sweden, they were politically independent of the Swedes and have now disappeared into legend and history. 50 years after becoming a Geatish king, Beowulf finds his realm terrorized by a dragon, who he then defeats, but is mortally wounded in the battle. After his death, his attendants cremate his body and erect a tower in his memory. Written sometime after the year 700, the full story survives in the manuscript known as the Noel Codex, now housed in the British Library. It has no title in the original manuscript, but has become known by the name of the story's hero. But besides being an entertaining saga, with great battles with monsters and dragons, could these be metaphors for actual events pertaining to historic wars grounded in true actual events? To gain some further insight, here is a brief clip of historian Brian Patrick McGuire, professor at Roskilde University in Denmark. Beowulf Beowulf is a tale of being a hero, of fighting for the good against evil. I'm Brian Patrick McGuire, and I'm a historian. I'm a lecturer at Roskilde University. We are in Lair, about 10 kilometers west of Roskilde, an important place in Danish history, since prehistoric times. Lair was built on royal tombs. I'm standing in a stone ship, which is a burial site, dating back to 500 to 1000 AD, the early Viking age. We have a tale about the beginning of it all, about a young boy called Tjold, and he was found on a ship that he had sailed into Lair, or Roskilde Fjord. And he was taken and brought here, where he was placed on a slab, where he was admired and accepted as the new king. King Skald, which he was called, created the Skildings. One of these was Hrothgar, who was a king and one of the protagonists in the poem about Beowulf. Beowulf is a story about fighting a monster. One believed that there was a hall here in Lair, a hall where the king's men enjoyed life, drank mead, and told of their deeds of valor. But then a monster started appearing at night, plucking out the men individually, eating them. The name of the monster was Grendel. Excavations were carried out here at Lier in the 80s and later, and revealed remains of some great halls. So the tale may rest on a historic foundation. Beowulf arrives and kills Grendel. But what happens when you kill the monster? A new, even more terrifying monster appears, namely Grendel's mother. She lives in a bog, and there happen to be quite a few bogs here at Lair. She appears, and Beowulf fights her for half a day. The Irish poet Seamus Heaney translated the poem so vividly that Beowulf became a bestseller once again, and in that respect, gained new life. Another instance of European folklore that involves the defeat of a menacing dragon comes to us from beautiful Krakow, the second largest and one of the oldest cities in Poland, near the border of the Czech Republic, and dating back to the 7th century. Krakow was the official capital of Poland until 1596, growing from a Stone Age settlement into one of the leading centers of Polish academic, economic, cultural, and artistic life, as well as one of Europe's most beautiful cities. The name Krakow is traditionally derived from Krakus, its legendary founder and ruler of the Lekites, a name given to certain tribes of West Slavic people, including the ancestors of modern Poles. In Polish, Krak essentially means town, but some attribute it to a Proto-Slavic word Krakula, meaning judge's staff, or another Proto-Slavic word krok, meaning oak, a sacred tree, which I'll cover in a future video. Today's episode will focus on the legendary Polish prince Krakus, who was first mentioned in the year 1190, and who, according to Polish legend, established a settlement above a cave that was occupied by a terrible dragon. The cave's entrance was at the foot of Wawel Hill, and none of the inhabitants of the town know where it had come from or how it got there, but everyone was afraid of it. According to the 13th century chronicles of a bishop of Krakow and historian of Poland, the dragon required weekly offerings of cattle, for if not appeased, the dragon would beat a path of destruction across the countryside, killing the civilians, pillaging their homes, and devouring their livestock. In many versions of the story, the dragon especially enjoyed eating young maidens, and could only be appeased if the townsfolk left a young girl in front of its cave once a month. The king tried many times to put a stop to the dragon, but his bravest knights fell to its fiery breath and deadly talons and jaws. In the versions involving the sacrifice of young girls, every girl in the city was eventually sacrificed except one, the king's daughter, Wanda. In desperation, the king promised to give his scepter, crown, and his beautiful daughter's hand in marriage to anyone who could defeat the dragon. Great warriors from near and far fought for the prize and failed. One day, a poor cobbler's apprentice named Croc accepted the challenge for the princess's hand. Another version of the story says he was a wizard, magician, or alchemist. In any event, he proceeded to stuff some lambskin with sulfur and set it outside the dragon's cave. The next morning, the dragon woke up hungry and ate it, and soon became incredibly thirsty, the sulfur causing its stomach to burn in agony. He turned to the Vistula River for relief and drank, but no amount of water could quench his aching stomach. And after gulping down so much of the river's water that his stomach continued to expand, he fell to the ground sick. Croc then came out from his hiding spot and started hurling stones at the dragon. The dragon tried to blow its fiery breath at Croc, but all that came out was steam. Still expanding with the contents of his stomach, the dragon finally exploded and died. The townspeople rejoiced. They were finally rid of this menace. Croc and the Princess Wanda married, and Croc took over the throne after the king died, in fulfillment of the promise he had made. A castle was constructed for King Crocus and Queen Wanda on top of Wawel Hill, directly over the dragon's lair, where the kings of Poland ruled from for the next few centuries. The townspeople named the sprawling settlement Krakow, in honor of their new king and his great feat. Today, the dragon is commemorated by a statue that breathes real fire. You could also visit the dragon's den and the Wawel Castle, built upon the Wawel Hill, and it's located in the very heart of Krakow, just by the Vistula River. According to some historians, the dragon was a metaphor for a race of people collectively known as the Avars, from the region known as the North Caucasus between the Black and Caspian Seas. Islam has been the prevailing religion of the Avars, or Huns, since the 13th century. The Avar swastika is a common symbol there since ancient times, as is the serpent and dragon. So, in an esoteric context, ancient stories concerning a fire-breathing winged dragon represented sex energy, where you could let it imprison and burn you, or you can tame and harness it into spiritual gold. The sacred knowledge of how to transmute life force energy was forced underground and became known as alchemy, the guarded techniques of occult secret societies, where initiates attempted to attain greater vitality, achievement, health, creativity, power, and allegedly even spiritual immortality. As these energetic carnal practices became outlawed by the church, along with Gnostic philosophies deemed heretical, many legends concerning dragons written during the Middle Ages started to incorporate a Christian element, as during the medieval period, many Europeans still held on to some of their prior pagan beliefs, and were trying to reconcile them with Christianity. Much of the pagan world revered serpent symbolism, as attested to by the ancient Greeks, Egyptians, Chaldeans or Mesopotamians, people of India, Asia, and of course, the Phoenicians, such as on this 8th century BC Phoenician pendant of a winged serpent. In Greek mythology, Hercules was said to have been the progenitor of a whole race of serpent-worshipping Scythians through his intercourse with the serpent Echidna. In Greek mythology, she was half beautiful maiden and half fearsome snake who lived alone in a subterranean cave and gave rise to the lineage of Scythian kings. the ancestral earth goddess of the Scythians, or Indo-European people, was the great dragon mother, mistress of the celestial waters, patroness of husbandry and fertility. She appears in the Iranian Avesta as a triple goddess, who the Aryan warriors address their request to grant them victory in battle, and to her, the Armenian king offered severed heads of defeated enemies after one of his important victories. The Scythians would also dedicate the blood and severed heads of their enemies to their ancestral mother, and she was often depicted carrying a decapitated head. According to the Scythians, and Sumerians for that matter, the king ruled as the chosen representative of the great dragon mother. The kingship in the Scythian tradition generally involved lakes and mysterious ladies, as it was the same in Britain, where the hero receives a sword that makes him the champion of nature. This had to do with an inner connection to the divine, which was later replaced with external authoritarian power structures. I go more into her folklore in my video on Melusine and dragon bloodlines, which I'll leave a link to in the description. The cultures that venerated and claimed descent from the great dragon of the pre-Christian era that is also mentioned in Revelation of the Bible were vilified, as were their esoteric practices, which included a communion with nature spirits and demons, a term which is derived from a Greek word for a supernatural spirit, which in its original context was not necessarily associated with evil. The Greek philosopher Socrates, for example, spoke of his demon as a spirit that inspired him to seek and speak the truth. Honorary 33rd degree Freemason Manly P. Hull wrote about these demons and his views of Christian church in the book The Secret Teachings of All Ages. Quote, "The Christian church gathered all of the elemental entities together under the title of demon. This was a misnomer with far-reaching consequences, for to the average mind the word demon means an evil thing, and the nature spirits are essentially no more malevolent than are the minerals, plants, and animals. Serpents and dragons also became evil, where they had been previously symbols of wisdom and eternity. They now came to represent opposing philosophies, tribes, and bloodlines. The esoteric elite of the ancient world, including Egypt, Babylon, and India, often called themselves the sons of the dragon and the serpent, practicing what later became known as Gnosticism, which still survives today in certain secret societies and mystery school religions. That said, serpents and dragons are also present in Viking folklore, which may have also been the original basis for a legend from Northern Europe, which tells of gigantic worms or legless serpents which terrorized the local area before being slain by a hero. County Durham is a cathedral city in northeast England. During the Middle Ages, the county was an ecclesiastic center, due largely to the presence of St. Cuthbert's shrine in Durham Cathedral. Cuthbert was a monk, bishop, and hermit, and after his death, he became one of the most important medieval saints in northern England, with a cult centered on his tomb, regarded as the patron saint of Northumbria. The Lambton Worm is a legend from County Durham and is one of the area's most famous pieces of folklore. The story is centered around John Lambton, heir of the Lambton Estate, County Durham, and his fierce battle with a gigantic worm or dragon that had been terrorizing the local villages. Details of the story have changed over time with each telling, as with most myths of this kind. The story reveals that a young John Lambton missed church one Sunday to go fishing in the river, and while walking to the river or setting up his fishing equipment, John receives warning from an old man, or a witch depending on who tells the story, that no good can come from intentionally missing church. It so happens that John Lambton hasn't been able to catch a single fish until the church service concludes, by which time he fishes out a small eel or worm-like creature with a salamander-like head, and in some stories, it's no bigger than a thumb or up to 3 feet in length, depending on the version. In some, it has legs, while in others, it's said to more closely resemble a serpent. At this point, the old man returns. John proudly claims that he caught the devil himself and decides to dispose of his catch by discarding it down a nearby well. The old man then issues further warnings about the beast's nature and then departs. After throwing it in the well, John eventually forgets about the creature and joins the Crusades, a series of religious wars sanctioned by the church in the medieval period. As time passes by, the worm grows immensely large, and villagers start to notice livestock going missing and discover that the worm, now fully grown, has emerged from the well and coiled itself around a local hill 7 times. The worm terrorizes the local villages, eating sheep and abducting small children. It then heads towards Lambton Castle, where the lord there somehow manages to sedate the creature in what becomes daily ritualistic offerings of milk from 9 cows. A number of brave villagers and even knights come forward to try to kill the beast, but to no avail, as when a chunk is cut off of the worm, it simply reattaches the missing piece. 7 years later, John Lambton returns from the Crusades to find his father's estates extremely impoverished. He decides to fight the beast, but first seeks guidance from a wise witch near Durham. The witch hardens John's determination to kill the beast by explaining his responsibility for the worm. She tells him to cover his armor in spearheads and to fight the worm in the river, that after killing the worm, he must then kill the first living thing he sees, or else his entire family will be cursed for 9 generations. John prepares his armor according to the witch's instructions. Before going to fight the beast, John arranges with his father that when he has killed the worm, he will sound his hunting horn 3 times. On receiving this signal, his father is to release his favorite dog so that it will run up to John, who can then kill the dog and avoid the curse. John Lambton then confronts the worm by the river, where it spent days wrapped around a great rock. The worm tried to crush him, wrapping him in his coils, but cuts itself due to the armor spikes. Chunks of the worm fall into the river and are washed away before the worm can reattach them to itself. Eventually, the worm is dead, and John, still aware of the curse, sounds his hunting horn 3 times. Unfortunately for him, though, John's father is so excited about the beast being dead that he forgets to release the hound and rushes out to congratulate his son. John cannot bear to kill his father, and so, after they meet, the hound is released and dutifully dispatched. But since John's father was the first living thing that he saw, and since he failed to kill his own father, 9 generations of the Lambton's family are cursed. That's where the story ends, and as for the curse, it seems to have held true. The story was made into a song written in 1867, which passed into oral tradition and has several slightly different variants.
Wish not, had you gobs, I'll tell you all an awful story. Wish not, had you gobs, I'll tell you the one. Once in the morning, Lambton went fishing in the weir. He catched a fish upon his yoke, he thought it awfully queer. Know what a kind of fish it was, young Lambton couldn't tell. He hadn't flashed to carry it, yet so he hoed it to the well. Wished, lads, had your gobs, I'll tell you all an awful story. Wished, lads, had your gobs, I'll tell you put the one.
Now Lambton felt inclined to gan and fighting for a was, and he joined a troop of knights that cared for neither wounds nor scars. So off he went to Palestine, where things him befell, and he very soon forgot about the queer war to the well. Wished, lads, had your gobs, I'll tell you all an awful story. Wished, lads, had your gobs, I'll
Well, the worm got fat and growed and growed and growed an awful size. He great big teeth and great big gob and great big goggly eyes. When at Neats he crawled about to pick up bits of news. If he felt dry up on the road, why he milked a dozen coos. Wished lads had your gobs, I'll tell yous all an awful story. Wished lads had your gobs and I'll tell yous about the war.
This awful worm that crawled about and eat up lambs and sheep, it swallowed little bairns alive as they lay down to sleep. And when that he had had enough and eat about his fill, he'd crawl away and lap his tail 10 times round Pincher Hill. Wish lads had your gobs, I'll tell yous all an awful story. Wish lads had your gobs, I'll tell yous about the worm.
Well, the news of this most awful beast and its queer gallons on soon crossed the seas and reached the ears of brave and bold Sir John. So home he came and catched the beast and cut him in 3 halves, and that soon stopped his eating bears and lambs and sheep and calves. Wish lads had to gobs, I'll tell you all an awful story. Wish lads had to gobs, I'll tell you about the world.
Soon knew you now who all the folks on both sides of the weir lost lots of sheep and lots of sleep and lived in mortal fear. So let's say one to brave Sir John, who kept the bairns from harm, save coos and calves by making halves of the famous Lambton Worm. Wished lads had your gobs, I'll tell yous all an awful story. Wished lads, had your gobs, I'll tell you about the worm. No, lads, I had me gob, that's all I know about the story of Sir John's clever job with the famous Lambton Worm. And that's that.
And that's that. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon, as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments, so please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.